Hi, I'm Mike. I was told Janie was gonna have a few words.
And
Well, Janie, go ahead. Yeah.
yes, I wanted to introduce Mike because in my first meeting, he said something I did not like. As a matter of fact, I thought he was nuts. Quería introducir a Mike porque en mi primer junta de Al-Anon, él dijo algo que no me gustó. Por supuesto, yo pensaba que estaba loco. And what he said was this, y lo que dijo era esto. Yo estoy tan orgulloso que tengo un alcohólico en mi vida. I am so grateful to have an alcoholic in my life. And today, I just wanted to say, Mike, everyone, I am so grateful to have an alcoholic in my life. Please, Mike.
Hi, I'm Mike, and I am grateful to have married an alcoholic, and today I'm grateful to be divorced from an alcoholic. I'm going to read just a real snippet from Courage to Change, page 311, which is November 6th. For me, the exact nature of my wrongs is the unspoken, self-defeating assumptions that give rise to my thoughts and actions. Now, my sponsor talked about that. He used vastly different vocabulary, and I'm going to get to that when I get to the fifth step. But I started off as a child, and I grew up in an unhealthy family with a domineering father and a submissive mother, and my father just controlled the family with vitriol, shame, and intimidation. And he railed against the sexual revolution, and he railed against women's rights, women's gender equality. And we just ran scared. When I was 4 years old, I got my mom alone, and in my little 4-year-old vocabulary, asked her to divorce him and move us to safety. And she said, "Oh, no, no. I can't. We can't. No, that's not possible." And I was so disappointed because life was so bad. I had a friend at the best job I ever had. His name was Eric, and he had a joke, and the joke was about customer support. He'd say, "We're not happy until you're not happy." And I just thought that was a funny joke until about four, let's see, 3 years ago, 2018, my father had gallbladder surgery, and I went to visit so I could support my mother. And I realized while I was visiting, the dynamic was, Dad wasn't happy until I was afraid. Dad wasn't happy until I was in fear. When I was in fear, I believe what happened was he felt he had control, and then he was comfortable. And so what I learned growing up was not to waste my time trying to have my own thoughts or my own reactions about things, just live in fear and make everything okay for Dad. The important thing was to make everything okay for Dad. I wasn't really somebody. And so when I was 22 in 1986, I moved to San Diego to go to school. And kind of what it was I was getting out of the foxhole for the first time, and I didn't know who I was. I hadn't had any life experience. I had spent my life just living in fear. But I'll tell you what, in San Diego, I met the most beautiful woman in the entire world. And I didn't realize that she was under the influence at the time. She's normally an introvert, but she was chemically extroverted that day, and she walked right up to me, stuck out her hand, and introduced herself. And I said to myself, that's the woman I'm going to marry. Like I said, I didn't know that she was under the influence. I didn't know myself. I didn't know this thing about, golly, some people aren't a good match, and maybe you should find somebody who is a good match. All I knew was if something wasn't going right, just dominate the situation and take over, because that's how it works. That's I'm from a long line of men that dominated like that. And when I started coming to Al-Anon, got a little psychotherapy, learned that it wasn't healthy, I began to resent my father. And this is a little like resenting gravity. It has absolutely no impact on gravity, and it ruins my whole day or decade, depending on how long I can run with it. What I knew when I looked at this woman was that I felt happy. I didn't know that that happiness was transient. I didn't know what happiness was, but damn it, I sure felt it that day. Okay, I didn't see much of her for about a year after that. She got into treatment, she got into recovery. She became an introvert and she didn't show up. If she did, she hid in corners. But about a year later, she consented to go on a date with me. And she came over to my house and I made her dinner. And then I said, let's go to a bar because I had heard about this really cool bar. Now, I'm going to tell you, I was a goody two shoes, but I was trying to move beyond that. And I was like spreading my wings. So I wanted to take her to this bar. And she said, okay. And we got in the car and we were going to this bar. And I said, I'm going to have a Kahlua and cream. What are you going to have? And she said, Diet Coke. And I said, it's a bar. And she said, I know. And I said, it's about the alcohol. And she said, I know. And see, I was feeling uncomfortable with the whole thing. And so I wasn't going to let up. I was going to try to take control and get involved in her decision. And so I kept pushing, what's the point of going to the bar and drinking Diet Coke, blah, blah, blah. And eventually she hit a limit and she said, look, I'm an alcoholic, I'm in recovery, and I don't drink. And I said, okay, well, let's go to a movie. And she said, okay. And we went to a movie and we had a wonderful time. And the next day, I called my mother because my mother had been in Overeaters Anonymous for as long as I could remember. And in those days, OA did not have its own literature. And we always had AA literature laying around the house. And I called her and said, could you send me an AA book? And she said, why? And I said, I'm dating an alcoholic. And she said, Michael, there are other girls you can date. But within a week, the AA's 12 and 12 appeared at my door. And I read it. And the first time I read the steps, I was struck by the power of the very words. I mean, I was just in awe. And I said, this is what my religion should have been teaching me my whole life. Why hasn't it? And so I decided I wanted to work the steps. And so she brought me to some AA meetings and I met some alcoholics and I went to an Al-Anon meeting and, I wasn't interested. But I got to know a bunch of alcoholics and I asked a bunch of them to be my sponsor. And they said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, no. And they said, no, I'm not going to sponsor you. Go to Al-Anon. And, I was not identifying with you people. I made the most reasonable mistake that was standing right in front of me, which was to work the steps myself. And I'm not going to go into that right now, except to say that I demonstrated for myself that the one who sponsors himself has a fool for a sponsor. I did eventually find a meeting of Al-Anon that I could come back to. It was on Mondays in La Mesa at, I think it was 3 in the afternoon. And I went there. Oh, I'm sorry. This was on May the 2nd, 1989. And I'll tell you what, I have more time in the program, more time in the fellowship than I have recovery. And I'll get to that as well. Okay, so at this meeting, there were like 25 women and 3 men, and that didn't bother me at all. I actually didn't like men. I was intimidated by them. And I was the youngest one at the meeting, but only by a lot. I was, what was I, 24 when I started going. And somebody said, go to two meetings a week for maintenance, three for growth. And so I started picking up a couple other meetings. And one of them, I'll tell you what, was at Lake Murray. And that was the best meeting. I don't know what the people said, but we were at the lake. And we brought our lawn chairs and we sat in a circle. And if it was raining, we brought umbrellas. And it was fellowship. Okay, 10 months of that. And then I moved to Livermore. So I had graduated in June of 1989, a month after I started going to Al-Anon meetings. And I was unemployed for 9 months. And so 10 months after I started going to meetings, I got a job and I moved to Livermore and I got a job at the lab. And I was underemployed and I was underpaid, but it was a job, damn it. And I went. And let's see, I started going to three or four meetings a week. I didn't have anything else to do. I didn't know anybody. And there was a meeting in the Presbyterian Church in Livermore on Wednesdays. And it was an adult child meeting. And I was going to this meeting and I was identifying with these people. And I was going, this is a good meeting. This is a good meeting. And I was going to that meeting for a month before I realized it's an adult child meeting. And I said, my parents are not alcoholics. Why am I identifying with the adult children? And I rolled that around in my brain for a while, and somebody said, you know, alcoholics don't have a corner on the market of dysfunctional parenthood. And, you know, that made perfect sense to me. And so for a while, I was saying, okay, I'm an adult child of an asshole. And I liked that. It helped me to fit in. At the time, as I said it, I was judging my father. Today, I realize the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree, and my father was doing the best that he could. And so I say it endearingly. Okay, in April that year, I went to District 16's Day in Al-Anon, and I met a man named Larry. And Larry was an alcoholic and an Al-Anon. He had 14 years in AA, 9 years in Al-Anon. I thought that was forever. I got his phone number, and eventually he became my sponsor. And I remember complaining to him that I was underemployed and underpaid. And he looked at me and said, you're not emotionally qualified for the jobs that you want. And I had no idea what that meant. We talked, and it came up that I was not at a bottom. I was madly in love with an alcoholic, and she was in recovery. Her drinking didn't bother me. She wasn't drinking. And I was not powerless, and my life was not unmanageable. I just wanted to work the steps. And what he said to me was, if you're not at a bottom when you start working a program, the program will bring you to a bottom. He didn't tell me that that would take 18 years, and I had no concept how painful it was going to be. So here we go. The only relationships that my childhood and my adolescence had prepared me for were relationships in which the husband slash dad dominated the family with vitriol, shame, and intimidation. And so there was a limited choice of women for me to date. But this gorgeous alcoholic dated me, and everything was going along fine until I found the need to dominate. And I started yelling at her. And, you know, she didn't cower in the corner the way my father had. She gave it back to me. Essentially, what happened was I taught her how to be dominant because she wasn't like that before. She was nice. She would talk to me. Things were fine. But I taught her how to be dominant. And I'll tell you what, when she got dominant, I got scared. It was like I was looking at my father. It triggered my PTSD. And, you know, I was off to the races. And after it took about 5 years, but eventually I became the submissive one. And I lived in fear. And the only thing that she couldn't get me to do by domination was to do the things that I was scared of because my father had convinced me not to do those things. But it was not a happy marriage, not even from the get-go. Okay, so here's a quick timeline or a moderate timeline. In 1990, that's when I moved to Livermore. I started working the steps. My girlfriend moved to Castro Valley, and so a little later, I moved to Castro Valley. And but we didn't live together because propriety, you know. And there were other things we didn't do that most couples were doing in the 90s because I didn't want to burn in hell. In 1991, we were married. In 1992, we bought a house and moved to Brentwood. And I had been working my steps for a couple of years at that point. And I guess I was more emotionally qualified because I took a new position at the lab, which increased my salary by about 65%. And that was a salary I was pleased to live with. So I'm already getting benefits from the program. The kids were born in 1993, 1995, 1997. One of them had special needs. Things got difficult. We had an explosive child. Things were really difficult. In 1997, the house was no longer big enough. And so we bought a new, bigger house that we could not afford. And my wife quit her job as a nurse and opened a preschool. Sorry, she opened a daycare, which eventually turned into a preschool. But I was stressed about money. And the debt started mounting. And I became increasingly more stressed about money as time went on. And from 1997 to 2006, everything in my life gradually declined. Work became less and less fun, more and more boring, more and more stressful, until it was just plain bad. And I dreaded waking up and going to work in the morning. The marriage, like I said, we were both overwhelmed with the amount of stuff there was to do around the house. It wasn't, we were not getting our basic needs met, and there was not enough of us to get our basic needs met. And, our third tradition talks about mutual aid. We come together for mutual aid. What we had in our marriage, I would classify more as mutual blame. And the debt kept growing, and my attitude kept getting worse and worse. Now, in 2000, she started threatening divorce, and that escalated my fear because, divorces. I guess my mom had taught me that it's not possible, and yet she was going to foist it on me, and I didn't know it was, it overwhelmed me emotionally. Now, the interesting thing about all this time was that I was working the steps and I was going to meetings, and I was getting better, and I was getting worse concurrently. And the only way I can explain that is to say that there was more than alcoholism going on in our lives. I had generalized anxiety, PTSD, sexual anorexia, and she had, let's just say that the rocks in her head fit the holes in mine. I was learning the principles. I was forgiving my father incrementally. I was making progress, but concurrently, things were getting worse. In 2006, the defecation hit the rotary oscillator in our marriage. In 2007, she kicked me out of the house under threat of violence, and she filed divorce. And I did not know what to do with myself. I was just defeated. And, I had started the men's meeting in District 16. I had started a meeting on site at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. I was sponsoring a couple guys. I thought I had a program. And I would show up in meetings and they would ask if there were any newcomers and I would raise my hand. It was just, well, I'll get to that. In 2008, I was still going through all of this and I got laid off from the lab. And I felt about that immense shame and immense hopelessness. And that's when I hit my bottom. And I'll tell you what, I felt incomprehensible demoralization. But I surrendered. And life started to turn around. And I went to a meeting. It was either that night or the next night. And the guy that was sitting next to me at that meeting worked at a company involved in what I had gotten my degree in, what my first job was in that I was underpaid at. It had been 16 years. I was no longer in that line of work. And I got hired at that company within a month. And, that field is, well, okay, medical physics. That's not the kind of field you can just hop into after you've been out for 15 months. That was a miracle. And I attribute that to God. I had been working a program, and finally I surrendered, and good stuff was coming into my life. Bad stuff was still there. I remember listening to Tom W. one time say, "Well, okay, faith does drive out fear, but it takes time to do this." In 2018, I started doing gratitudes with a friend, an Al-Anon friend. I was commuting at that point from Brentwood to Newark, and I would call my buddy, or he'd call me every morning around 6, and we would say things that we're grateful for. And do you know, studies have been done now. If you're doing that sort of thing, writing down things you're grateful for every day, talking to somebody about things you're grateful for every day, it changes the neural pathways in your brain so that you start thinking happier thoughts, thinking fewer unhappy thoughts. And you know what? That's worth the price of admission. Okay, so what has happened in my life, what I have noticed through the course of the program, is that I learned the principles and then I learned the skills. So I'm going to give you an example of this. My first fourth step, I worked a fourth step and I realized I was dominating my wife and my children and others. And essentially, I was an ass. I had become the ass that my father had been. And I realized that's counter to the principles. And so I made the decision not to try to dominate people. And then one day, my wife and I went to the Sears outlet in San Leandro to buy a major appliance. And they pointed out the woman that we would need to talk to about it. And I looked at her and I immediately profiled her. I didn't realize I was profiling her. I certainly didn't intend to profile her, but it was my thinking that happened lightning speed in my unconscious, quicker than you could I don't know, whatever you do real quick. And what came to me was, I am not going to yell at this woman. I made a decision. I am not going to yell at this woman. I might have even said it out loud to the woman that was my wife at the time. And we went over and we started talking to her. And within 10 minutes, I was yelling at this woman. I had learned the principle about not trying to dominate people, and I was powerless over my behavior. And we left without a major appliance. And I was just bewildered. We were driving away, and I was like, what the hell happened? I knew I wasn't going to yell at her. I knew. I mean, I really meant this. So I think this has a lot to do with the fact that we have so many preparatory steps, right? Step 8 is not making amends. Step 6 is not humbly asking, and step 3 is not turning it over. If step 3 were turning over our lives and will to a God of our understanding, I'd have never made it. Because I was able to make a decision, but I didn't know how to do it. I had the principle, I didn't have the skill. And I needed to work steps 4 through 9 before I was capable of turning things over. And I'm not going to say like I'm a superstar turner over, but I'm better in it than I used to be. The trouble with the steps is they can be very challenging. They're very humbling. Bill says they are ego puncturing. I say they are painful. My first step to, I remember I was sitting in my sponsor's living room, and he was telling me I had more to unlearn about God than I had to learn about God, which was true. And what I knew about God had scared me out of my own natural sexuality. I was just afraid of hell. Essentially, I didn't want to live in my father's house for eternity. But the thing that they had told me growing up was, this is the religion, and if you stop believing this, you're going to hell. So they built right into it a mechanism to prevent me from getting out. It was like an iron curtain. And so my sponsor found me a very frustrating sponsoree. And he told me I was overthinking. And, that offended me. Of course, it was true, but it offended me. A lot of the things that he told me, I didn't believe him. And I'm going to say a lot of things tonight that I didn't believe when I heard them the first time. And if you don't believe, if this is your first time hearing some of this stuff and you don't believe it, you don't have to. That's fine. Take what you like. And I'm not an expert at this stuff. I don't have a degree in psychology. I don't have a degree in Al-Anon. So I'm just some guy, and this is my experience. So I would sit in his living room, and he would say things like, "Mike, you're a really smart person. You've got to be the smartest person I know." And that's not a compliment, it's just a description. And what he meant was that I was overvaluing my own intelligence, and he wanted me to know it's not a virtue, it's just a trait. And today I realized that the brain is an auxiliary organ, and if it doesn't take its lead from spirituality, it has no choice but to run itself into the ground. Now, what I thought was my spirituality in those days was composed of my professed beliefs, which, let me tell you, are thoughts. But he paid attention to my emotions, and they indicated to him that my faith was dead. And so, but all I knew was logic. I had taken a logic class in college, and I just thought it was an easy A until about halfway through when I realized that there were some people in the class that were struggling to pass the class. And I remember turning around, I was sitting in the front row. And I turned around and looked at somebody that was asking a question, and there was fear on his face, and I could identify with the fear. And I didn't judge him because I knew that fear. But thought it was weird that it wasn't just obvious, because obviously the stuff was just obvious. And what I know today is logic is just something that comes naturally to me. And it's not a basis of a spirituality. And I had been trying to go forward with a logical approach to spirituality my whole life. And the Tao that can be written is not the living Tao. And even rectal thermometers have degrees. I actually heard an alcoholic named Mildred F. told me that. Okay, I think it's wonderful. The word know. So in English, we have the word know, KNOW, to know something. I think it's wonderful that the Latin languages have two different words that this could be translated into. In Spanish, we've got saber and conocer. And saber means like to know facts, to be conscious of something, to be, well, that. Conocer, on the other hand, is more to be acquainted with, to be familiar with. Everything that I had learned about God growing up, the Spanish speakers would apply the word saber. Everything I learned about Al-Anon, sorry, about God in Al-Anon would be more conocer. I got to know God like I know a close friend. And that is just wonderful. My sponsor would sit there and say, "You can't be too dumb for the program, but you can be too smart for it." And sometimes he would accuse me of being too smart, and I wouldn't get angry about that. But I mean, I had to admit there were huge swaths of reality that were going by me that I was missing. I was not taking them in. They were not amenable to scientific analysis, and I was missing it. And so he would hammer on on emotions. And we talked every week, we would talk about emotions because I needed repetition. So there was one significant exercise that he gave me to write about a particularly harrowing experience I had had with my father as an adolescent, in which he had ripped me a new one for something I hadn't done. And he said, "I want you to pay particular attention to your emotions as you write this." And so I went and I wrote it, and I thought I had done a great job. I certainly was feeling the emotions as I wrote it. I thought the emotions were jumping out of the page. And so when I got there and I read it to him, and I sat back triumphantly, he looked at me and he said, "Mike, you did a great job describing the events, and you didn't use a single feeling word." And I was just dumbfounded. I didn't know what he wanted me to do. And what he did was he took the notebook where I had written all this, and he said, "You don't have to write it again." But he put little numbers at the end of sentences and clauses and called them feeling notes. They were footnotes. He called them feeling notes. And he said, "I want you to go back and write numbers, down at the bottom, and tell me what you were feeling at each of these points in the story." And that's kind of the level of remedial help I needed. In retrospect, if there had been a college class on feeling your feelings, I would have been the one struggling to pass. In fact, it might have been undoable. So why are emotions so important? And I've got three reasons for that. And the first is I feel them. Reptiles don't have emotion. Reptiles have affect, which is purely physiological. Some threat appears. The affect of fear arises in the body, and they take action. If they survive the incident, the affect goes away 15 seconds after the stimulus has been removed. It's very simple. They don't walk around and keep pointing back to it the rest of their lives. For mammals, we have memory, and this adds a mental component to the affect, which forms emotion. And if you remember the thing that scared you, you can get scared again. And this was happening for me my whole life. And the way to resolve an emotion is to feel it completely. So it's important to be able to identify, label, and feel my emotions so that I can complete them and they can go away and stop wreaking havoc in my life. The next reason why emotions are so important is that they contribute to my conscious contact. I don't know about you people, but God generally does not communicate with me by means that can be translated into a text. Now, sometimes I feel a nudge to read a particular book, but what's the nudge? I mean, there are a lot of really good books out there that I do not have time to read that, golly, I wish I did. But when I get a nudge, I follow it and I read, or I do whatever the nudge says, or at least I try to. The nudge is not something I see, it's not something I feel, it's not something, well, it's not something I hear, and it's not something I feel with the nerve endings in my skin, which is what we generally think of as the sense of touch. It's something I feel in my heart. It's something I feel in my gut. It's something I feel inside. Feel inside. What else do I feel inside? I feel my emotions inside. The physical component of the emotion is called affect, but it's still there. And if I'm learning how to pay attention to the feelings I'm feeling on the inside, that's a fast pass for me to be conscious of the nudges I'm getting from God. Now, I can sit there for weeks intending to do God's will, but until I feel a nudge, I don't know what it is. Okay, the third reason emotions are so important is part of an important feedback loop. And I'm going to describe that when I get to step five. Sorry, yeah, step five. Okay, I did not come to Al-Anon. Sorry. They say most people, they say nobody comes to Al-Anon on a good day. But I did. I came to Al-Anon not because my life was a shambles. I came to
Mike F.
can you check your mic?
Check my mic. Is that better?
You knocked it and it not the volume's low now.
Can you hear me now?
It's not back to where it was.
How about now? Hello, can you hear me?
It's still
It's built into my computer. I don't know what else to do. I can call in on my phone.
I can hear him by increasing my volume.
Yeah, I think that's a better thing to do.
Shall I talk?
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you for piping up. I came to Al-Anon because it was a smart thing to do. I intended to marry an alcoholic, and it would be smart to go to Al-Anon. And in fact, it was smart to come to Al-Anon. What was stupid was to try to think my way through it. There's a scene in iRobot. Will Smith plays the main character, and he's talking to the computer engineer, and he tells her, "You have got to be the dumbest smart person I know." And I think that describes me. I just kept trying to do my spirituality by thinking it, and it just kept not working. And step two kind of broke me in that respect. And what eventually happened was my sponsor wore me down with cognitive dissonance, and I eventually essentially stopped believing what it was that I had believed. But I didn't come to believe it in anything. I simply believed that a power could restore me. And I'll tell you what, that is an austere place from which to try to work a third step. I'm going to turn my life and will over to what? I don't know. And so he gave me some assignments. He told me to go out and read books about various spiritual traditions. In fact, he gave me a book. The author of the book was a spiritual mentor of Dr. Bob, actually. And it offered an alternative perspective of Christianity, and I needed that. And I also studied Buddhism, Hindu, Islam, Native American spirituality, and Wicca. And I found, contrary to what I had been taught growing up, that none of these were evil. They were generally about love and about conscious contact and about all the things that I'm learning to try to get into my life in Al-Anon. I realized, it was God that had invented religious diversity in the first place. That's kind of what the story of the Tower of Babel was about. And so I was better able to detach from what I would today consider religious abuse growing up. When I finished my fourth step, I thought I had finished my fifth step. Everybody I knew, they read their fourth step to their sponsor, that's their fifth step. My sponsor said no. He said, in your fourth step, you had uncovered your behavior patterns. Now, in your fifth step, we're gonna extrapolate back to find the exact nature of your wrongs. We're gonna extrapolate your behavior patterns back to your emotional patterns. We're gonna extrapolate your emotional patterns back to your thought patterns. We're gonna extrapolate your thought patterns back to your core beliefs. And now this is the feedback loop I was talking about. Because going forward, the way this works is I have this set of core beliefs that I brought with me out of childhood. And I perceive things. And as I perceive them, I interpret them in light of my core beliefs. Two people can see the same thing and come away thinking two different things about it because they have two different sets of core beliefs. Core beliefs, not to be confused with professed beliefs, are unconscious, and I don't know what they are until I've done the research project. So I perceive something, I interpret it. I interpret it in light of the core beliefs. Those interpretations are thoughts. I have thoughts, the thoughts evoke emotions, the emotions motivate behaviors. And once I do a behavior, that's there for the world to see. It could be my action. It could be my word. It could be something subtle. I could be rolling my eyes, some kind of facial expression, voice tone, body language. Rolling my eyes was a big thing that my ex-wife really hated. I do a behavior, the world sees it, the world responds. The world responds, I perceive the world's response, and the whole thing starts all over again. This is the feedback loop. Now, I've already told you, when I was at the Sears outlet, I was powerless over my behaviors. My sponsor would sit there and say, your behaviors are motivated by your emotions. And I would say, no. My behaviors come out of my thoughts. And he would say, no. Your behaviors come out of your emotions. And in retrospect, he was right. I'm powerless over my behaviors. And he would say, your thoughts evoke your emotions. And I would say, no. Other people do stuff to me, and that evokes my emotions. So I had a harder time coming to believe that. But here's what I know today. I've got more than 5 input streams feeding information to my brain every day on a continuous basis, and it is more information than I can consciously keep track of. And my unconscious is a million times more powerful than my conscious mind. It is faster, it has more resources, and it forgets nothing. And my unconscious mind is dealing with all the incoming information, and when it decides that there's something that should be escalated to the conscious mind to deal with, it doesn't just say, these are the perceptions. It interprets them, so that's an unconscious thought, in light of the core beliefs, and then an emotion is evoked, and it sends up the whole package all at once. The perception, the thought, the emotion, not the belief, unfortunately. And so I'll be sitting there, and the only thing that I'm consciously aware of is I see the perception and I feel the emotion. And to me, it seems like the thing that I saw evoked the emotion, but I was thinking unconsciously. It's going on there. So emotions are part of this feedback loop. And Gandhi talked about integrity. And what Gandhi said is it's to be integrated, to be able to integrate your thoughts, your emotions, and your behaviors. And if I can't identify, label, and feel my emotions, I don't have that kind of integrity. Okay, but Larry said that when I get to the 7th step and I turn over to God, my emotional patterns, my thought patterns, and my core beliefs, that's when my behavior will change. And when my behavior changes, that's when I'll like the things that the world gives me better. Now, I had an experience when I was a small child. I used to go to the bathroom and turn on the faucet and hold my hand under the faucet and try to stop the flow of water with my hand. And I couldn't do it. No matter how hard I pressed, I could not stop the water coming out by holding my hand to get the faucet. I had to stop it at the source, which was the handle to turn off the water. And that's an analogy for me for how I change my behaviors. I can't do it by addressing the behaviors. I do it by addressing my thoughts and my emotions. So I have this unconscious mind. It believes, it perceives, it interprets, it feels, and it behaves. Now, its interpretations are thoughts. They are unconscious thoughts. I also have conscious thoughts. I have control over my conscious thoughts. I just don't have control over my unconscious thoughts. But this, and so the father, sorry, Tom W. was saying, first thought wrong. That first thought wrong thing is the automatic thought that's coming from the lizard brain. That's how I see that. I'm grateful I have a frontal cortex today. Anyway, this cycle, this process is happening within me automatically every day, all the time, and I'm powerless over it. And so There's got to be a spiritual solution. Okay, I've got 15 minutes left. I'm going to skip some stuff. I will tell you that in and among all the books that I read during my third step, I kept getting this repeated message, which was that the default state of the human mind is peace, love, and joy. And I did not believe that. My default state was not peace, love, and joy. It was absolute misery. But then there came a day when I received a nudge from my higher power to read a particular book by a neuroanatomist who had had a stroke. And she talked about brains, and she talked about strokes scientifically and experientially. It was really cool, really. And she had lost part of the brain that is very analytical and nitpicky details, and the part of the brain that is remembering all the things that are wrong. And when she stopped having that part of her brain that would remind her of all the things that are wrong in the world and all the things that are wrong in her life, she felt better. She said, the way she put it, I was in nirvana. And that's when I got it. All those spiritual teachers had said it, and I didn't believe it. But she gave it to me from her experience, and then I believed it. Okay, but then I was in trouble. Because, you know, prior to 2008, I never stopped thinking. I argued with my ex-wife continuously, whether she was there or not. I spent my commutes driving to and from work. You know, I said this and she said that and she was wrong and it's really like this and that's why we have all those problems. And I was just feeding these thoughts to myself over and over again like a hamster wheel. And it was driving my emotions down the tube. So after I figured out that my sponsor had been right, I had been wrong, that my emotions follow my thoughts, I started practicing a new set of skills, turning the other cheek, thinking off topic. You know, just because something is true doesn't mean it's worth my time to dwell on it. And I received a couple of nudges to read a couple of books concurrently. And one was about meditation and one was about affirmation. And the book on meditation said, whatever's happening, whether you like it or not, just let it be. Don't grasp at it. Don't push it away. Don't judge it. It just is. If it is, it is okay. Because if it is, it's of God. And just let it be. And the book on affirmation said, don't waste your time thinking thoughts that make you miserable. Think thoughts that you can be happy about. Think thoughts that fill you with joy. Choose your thoughts. Like, if I have discretionary thoughts, I'm going to invest them wisely. And so the meditation book was about acceptance. And the affirmation book was about changing my thinking. And this is starting to feel familiar to me, right? Accept, change. And what I got to from that was accepting my emotions means feel it, don't think about it, feel it, right? If I'm thinking about it, I could be triggering it again because I'm a mammal. So the trick for me with difficult emotions is to feel them without thinking about them. And then when I have discretionary thoughts to think about the things that bring joy. Think about the solution. Think about... if I can't come up with my own good thoughts, I can call somebody. So here's an example. The day we signed the divorce agreement, this was December 2017. It was the two of us and a mediator, and we signed it, and I went outside, and I cried. And I just was overwhelmed with emotion, and I was, of course, sad. I was lonely. I was disappointed. I was in grief. And when it passed, I saw before me a trailhead to the path that spiraled down into despair and misery. And I made the decision, I'm not going to walk that way. Now, I didn't have the ability at that particular moment to think happy thoughts, but I knew what to do. I called my sponsor and I got my ass to a meeting and I felt better. And today I realize I am responsible for my emotions. They've been telling me for years I'm responsible for emotions and I never understood that. But other people can't make me feel stuff. I'm the one who creates my own emotions. So I hear the word wait batted around in meetings and people say it stands for, why am I talking? For me, wait stands for, what am I thinking? Because if I'm just rehashing some miserable thing, I'm just going to create more misery for myself. Today, if I'm feeling miserable, it's not my parents' fault, it's not my ex-wife's fault, and it's not the president's fault. I'm surrounded by infinite good, and I have the choice where to put my focus and what I'm going to think about. And I do have the choice how I'm going to think my conscious thoughts. And for that, I can be grateful. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when loved ones make stupid decisions, I can grieve. I can place them in God's hands. I can mind my own business and I can focus on the solution. And if there's something really big to grieve, somebody dies, somebody breaks up with me, what I know today is that grief will come in waves. There'll be periods of a lot of emotion and periods of less emotion. And it gives me the opportunity when the wave hits and there's a lot of emotion to stop thinking and just feel the feelings. And as it subsides, to focus on the solution. The wave hits, feel the feelings. The wave subsides, focus on the solution. Invest my discretionary thoughts wisely. I am not happy all the time, but when I'm not happy, I know what I'm feeling and I know what my options are. And for that, I am grateful. And if I have really big emotions, depression, really big anger, fear, whatever it is, I've got 6 tools: reading, writing, talking, listening, prayer, and meditation. They're all forms of communication, and they all help me to get to a place where I can feel my feeling and let it go. It's important, though, to choose what I'm reading, what I'm writing, what I'm saying, and what I'm listening to, and what I'm praying wisely. Okay, when in 2007, the first time that my ex-wife filed for divorce and I just didn't know what to do with myself, I was talking to somebody, a wise woman told me, by the time your kids are out of diapers, the most important thing you can do for them is to set a good example. Now, I did not believe that. And yet, my first fourth step demonstrated that I was an ass, that I was dominant, that I was doing all the stuff my father had done. My first fourth step showed me that I was living my life following his example. And my second fourth step showed me that I was living life following my mother's example. I was a doormat. I was submissive. And today I believe the most important thing I can do for my kids is to set a good example, because that's forming their core beliefs and that's what's going to drive their unconscious thoughts. And today I realize that the most important thing I can do for them or for anybody is to work my program, find my joy, live my life, and love. The 12th step says we try to carry the message to others. It doesn't say we use words. The most powerful way for me to spread the message is by example. And if somebody asks, I use words. But I'm going to tell you what, nobody's going to ask if I'm miserable or if I can't manage my own life or if I'm a judgmental bastard. So, example. In 2017, when I moved out of the house, I separated from my wife. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Al-Anon has a lot of tools, and many of them are in place to help us to feel better. Feeling better is important to get us to a place where we can work the steps. The steps don't usually make me feel better in the moment. They usually make me feel worse in the moment, but the steps make me be better. I did 90 meetings in 90 days to clear out the garbage in my life so that I could have a clear mind to work my next round of steps. And then my sponsor, Tom, who lives in Maui, suggested I start using the reaching for personal freedom to work my next round of steps. And I'll tell you what, I have a love-hate relationship with reaching for personal freedom. But on the second step, it poses this question. What changes have I seen in my life that I attribute to a power greater than myself restoring me to sanity? I read that question and I prayed and I started to answer it. And I came up with 32 bullet points with 11 sub bullet points. And I sat back and I was amazed. I was simply in awe. I didn't see it coming. There was stuff on that list dating back to the bad old days. There was stuff there from my miserable marriage. There was stuff there from my miserable childhood. I was seeing God showing up in my life the entire time. It was I who hadn't recognized God showing up in my life and hadn't taken advantage of it. But God was there. And today, I still am in awe of that exercise. You know, the big book, I would love to quote it. I don't have it memorized and I don't have it available right now. It has a purpose statement where it says, the reason we wrote this book is to help you find a God that will solve your problems for you. Oh, it doesn't say God. It says power greater than yourself. We wrote this book to help you find a power greater than yourself who can solve your problems for you. It doesn't say to help you solve. It doesn't say God's going to help. It says God's going to do it. And today I am grateful that the power greater than me is showing up in my life and is doing it. And I'm grateful that this power has been showing up my entire life. And I'm grateful I'm finally letting this power do it. Okay, 2 minutes left. What's it like today? Today, I love my job. My job loves me. I'm the de facto technical lead of our little group, and I enjoy the respect and admiration of my peers and supervisors. Today, I go to 3 meetings a week, and I work the steps with a sponsor, and I still work them slowly, and that's okay. I'm finishing up the 9th step of the round of steps I started after that 90 meetings in 90 days after I separated. I sponsor a couple guys, and I learn a lot from them. And I'm grateful that every time we're together, I hear exactly what I need to say, sometimes from them, sometimes from me. But I wouldn't have heard it from me had I not been in conversation with them. I'm grateful to be divorced. I'm grateful that my finances are in order. I'm dating like it's the 21st century. Well, like it's a pandemic in the 21st century. I don't always know what I'm doing, and that's okay, but I have the requisite skills for emotional intimacy. I treat women with respect, and I allow myself to explore reality instead of insist that it meet an arbitrary standard set by an order of celibate men. I have boundaries. I don't try to dominate, and I'm not a doormat. Today, I believe Abraham Lincoln about folks being as happy as they make up their minds to be. I began seeking meditations and inspirations for peace, love, and joy, and I found them, and they helped me to be happy. This morning, I woke up, and without even trying, a meditation started within me. And within a couple of minutes, I could feel my heart heating up. I could feel the presence of God in my life. And I was just grateful that, you know, this kind of meditation is now what's happening automatically in my life. and my behaviors have changed, and the responses that I receive from the world have changed, and I like it a whole lot better. You know, they say happiness is an inside job, but when you find it inside, you will find it outside. And I didn't believe it, but it's happening. And, you know, this program takes effort. It takes will, and it takes a village. And I am so grateful for the village. I'm so grateful for you people for being there for me, walking all the way through this. I'm grateful to Jeannie for asking me to speak, for the committee, for the tech people. I'm grateful to, for Allison. I loved your share. I am grateful for you know, all the wonderful things that have come up today. And it's a privilege and an honor to be asked to speak. I appreciate your attention this whole time, and keep coming back.